Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Richard Boley, Director of the Office of E-Diplomacy within the U.S. Department of State. Also joining our conversation today is Dan Chenick, Executive Director of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. So, Richard, there's a growing effort within the State Department to harness technology and a commitment to global service among young people, sort of to facilitate a new form of diplomatic engagement. Would you elaborate on your efforts in this area and the role of the Virtual Student Foreign Service Program?
Yeah, so Secretary Clinton launched the Virtual Student Foreign Service Program in her NYU commencement address in May of 2009. And our office got the nod to develop it and ramp it out. And we started with a digitizing the typical internship, where you would have a one-to-one correspondence between an office or an embassy or consulate and a student working on a project over a period of time. And that was tremendously successful. We've seen the number of offices and embassies and consulates offering projects increase dramatically year to year. But we've seen an even faster growth in the number of students wanting to participate. So, for instance, last year we had a little over 200 discrete positions or projects to work on, and had over 1,400 students applying. We expect that to double easily this year. There's a number of benefits to this. One is not every kid has the opportunity to take an unpaid summer internship at the State Department or at an embassy. It's just not part of their financial reality. And so it gives a chance for them to, kids like that, to come and engage with the State Department, understand what diplomacy is about, and we as a diplomatic corps will better reflect the breadth and diversity of America. The second is that it allows skill sets that are hidden to be uncovered. So one embassy said, we're looking for somebody with linguistic skills and a background in archaeology. They didn't think they'd find somebody. They found three people with those skills. So this has been the core Virtual Student Foreign Service internship program. The 2.0 version is to kind of take advantage in the virtual world what you can't do in the real world. So in the real world, I can't work today in Embassy Ouagadougou and tomorrow in Embassy in Buenos Aires and the day after in the embassy in Pretoria. But virtually I can. Mm-hmm. So we have a micro-tasking platform which allows embassies and consulates and offices in the State Department to put out a discrete task, completely unclassified, out on a website where students can apply and enter in, and they can do those tasks. And it provides an opportunity for them to bring their expertise in these discrete tasks. And the flip side is it's teaching our State Department employees how to chunk their work, how to think about discrete chunks that can be handed off to somebody else, which we believe in the long run will make them more efficient and effective employees. And you could envision a day in the future where we could have this internal marketplace where, again, as I'd mentioned before, I worked on migrant remittances. There may be an office that needs somebody to work on migrant remittances for a discrete task, and I could work on that. Somebody else could want to work on some issue in e-diplomacy. They could work on that. You would have this a little bit like Google's 20% time or 3M's 20% time, where part of your time could be spent working on a task that wasn't directly in your chain of command.
And what's interesting about all of this and the leveraging of social media and the tools that you talked about is the fact that the physical presence doesn't limit you. So I'd like to take that question and turn it around to limitation of states' physical presence. How are you using online solutions to do outreach? And for instance, what about the virtual presence post, and what are some of the challenges and benefits of pursuing such an effort?
So the virtual presence post was actually the first program to come out of e-diplomacy, and it's one that's evolved tremendously as technology has evolved. So when e-diplomacy, think back 10 years ago, websites were the purview of the webmaster. It was not an interactive space. It was a static space. And so what we developed, the Virtual Presence Post program, as a way for embassies to create a targeted outreach strategy to either a demographic group or a geographic group. So demographic could be Mayan speakers in Central America, demographic the second city in a country where you have an embassy but no consulate there. And you could engage with them and you could keep track of that engagement. What we found is as things have evolved, as online communities have grown and become more interactive, the need for a static website is disappeared. So what now happens, this is really a do-it-yourself initiative by embassies and consulates where they say, this is the group we're trying to reach. This is where they live on the web. This is where we're going to engage them. And whether that's, you know, Facebook or Orkut or any other social media, they find the appropriate place to engage them. So that this has evolved tremendously, and it's really evolved to the point now where we don't manage it. It's managed all directly by embassies and consulates directly themselves.
So you've got a number of innovative initiatives like that. I'd like to know a little bit more about two other initiatives. One is Tech at State, and the other is Tech Camp. How do these efforts bring together civil society, technologists, and technology with the effort to aid U.S. diplomacy and development? How do they promote linkages across the divide between technologists and the rest of the state workforce?
These are two great, strong initiatives that have started only in the last couple of years. First, I'll talk about Tech at State, which is a quarterly conference, which is a two-day quarterly conference. It's got a deep dive into an area of convergence between diplomacy, development, and technology. For instance, we've looked at mobile money, open source software, data visualization, real-time awareness. And upcoming, we're going to co-host Wikimania. It's a global gathering of Wikipedians. And the goal there is to really find two groups that may often look at the same issue from different perspectives, but rarely in the same room, and pull them together in the same room. We try to get a good keynote speaker who will draw in a strong crowd. Usually we get 300 or 400 people to come physically, another 10 times that online. And then in the afternoon, we end up doing more narrower slices into a narrower facet of the issue. And the second day is an unconference. So the agenda is set by the participants. Usually, although not this, not for Wikimania, usually we do that on a Saturday because we want the people who are passionate about it to come. And it's always a very creative, and oftentimes ventures and initiatives have been launched by people who've met at the Tech at State. Now moving on to Tech Camps. Tech Camp is a wonderful platform that allows for technologists who are specialized in low-cost, easy-to-implement technology, things like SMS, open source mapping, the use of blog software, very easily accessible, but using kind of unique uses. And then civil society organizations who know well what they're trying to address, but aren't really sure what technology can do. And they may even be, you know, analog NGOs, you know, technophobes. And by pulling them together in a two-day conference where the focus is not on the technology, the focus is on the problems that civil society organizations are trying to address, they can often come up with solutions using these technologies that they even begin to build sometimes during these two-day sessions. They really are magical, and we've increasingly been working with organizations that are trying to see how to fund solutions. We said, this is the way you should start. Start by doing a tech camp, and you will uncover things that you would never uncover through a standard RFP.
So these initiatives are great examples of how to make information flow to the right people at the right time, which is really the power of information in an organizational context. Can you elaborate a little bit on your efforts to enhance and foster information sharing across the extended foreign affairs community? How do you talked before about moving from the need to know to need to share environment where information is shared as part of the standard operating procedure. How does this play into that?
So one area which is, if you think of a sister organization, USAID. USAID is focusing on development. We're focusing on diplomacy, but we're oftentimes, sometimes co-located, and we work very closely together. Our missions are overlapping. So we've had this, the ITTI, it's the IT Transformation Initiative. And the goal is to pull state and USAID onto a platform without either having to give up something. So it's not dragging one to the other's platform, but build a platform that allows both to do the work that they're doing well. And I was down in Lima, Peru, which was one of the early ITTI posts, embassies, and by showing some of the platform, these collaborative platforms that we have to the USAID employees, it kind of sweetens the, the challenge or sweetens the change. If you say, sure, there's some anytime there's change is difficulty. You have to learn how to do things differently, or what used to be on your lower right hand one mouse click is now an upper left two clicks. But if you can show people if you can kind of get over that hump, here are Diplopedia communities at State, Corridor, Sounding Board, all available for your use. That's been helpful. The others, as I mentioned, our communities at State, two-thirds of them are more broadly open on an extranet to the interagency community. So.
Great. So expanding beyond the State community and the government community, State's digital initiatives are encouraged behind the firewall. Are there any plans to open these to the general public? And how do you balance in that environment sort of cyber risks that might come into play with the desire to increase openness?
I think it's a good question. I'm often asked that. I don't think, you know, anytime soon we would be opening up Diplopedia or communities. I mean, frankly, part of the argument for having all this platform behind the firewall is it allows collaboration to happen in a safe space. The argument is if we didn't provide the safe space behind the firewall, people would be doing this in a less secure environment out on the web. I could foresee some specific examples where there would be some more information sharing. But in general, I don't think those platforms would be open. But I think the learning that happens by collaboration behind the firewall opens the door to a more open and transparent collaboration with people on the outside. So I like to say it's like, you know, learning to ride with your training wheels on. You can do it behind the firewall, and you know, if you trip up in your learning process, it's not as the cost is not as high as if you were doing it out in public. So part of that socialization is really important, and I think it'll make us better at collaborating externally.
The idea of making it better, I'd like to focus on that. You've done a wonderful job today, Richard, outlining the many platforms and initiatives you're pursuing in e-diplomacy. How are you judging their success? And what I want to get at is, are you using analytic tools? And if so, how are you strengthening the use of these tools to assess the success of these programs and platforms?
That's a great question, and it's something that we often ask ourselves. Each of the platforms have their own native analytics tool, but they don't allow for then analytics across platforms. So about 6 months ago, we started looking at a platform, a software that would allow us to do cross-platform analysis. So that's in the works now, and we hope that allows us not only to see how information is being used across from Diplopedia to communities and from communities to Corridor, but also to be able to analyze that by location and really to enrich our knowledge of who's using our products and who's not, and how we can go after those targets of opportunity. So it's a great question. It's something that we're currently dependent more on these the native analytics for each platform, as well as success stories. We understand that there's a need for more, and we're working on that now.
I'd like to actually focus on the end user of many of these platforms. How are you making sure that they are satisfied? What are you doing to sort of enhance their level of satisfaction with each platform, each program?
Well, one thing that I haven't mentioned is search. So we do enterprise search. There's a million plus documents that are cataloged and archived and are retrievable through enterprise search. And that's an example of how we have a prominent box that says, you know, I didn't find what I was looking for. And you click that, and it sends your search, the terms that you put and what you were looking for, to a small team, which usually within minutes responds by saying one of three things. One, we don't have anything on that. We should. So we start a Diplopedia article, which serves as kind of a squib to begin to flesh that out. Two, that the information, the way the search was done was going to get the wrong output, but by using this different terms, you'd get what you're looking for. So it's a teachable moment. We do that quick response, and oftentimes people are surprised that there's kind of a human at the other side of that. We spend a lot of time, I think, you know, being self-critical, saying, you know, if let's not fall in love with our own platforms. Let's find out what end users, who's using it, where we're solving their pain points, where they're just walking away from it because it's not, and how do we then make our platforms more valuable to solve the problems that people really have.
Can I ask a follow-on? Because I'm interested with your background in entrepreneurialism, and is there a private sector or even a public sector organization that sort of you model your response from, and who's influenced you in how you handle these satisfaction issues?
So actually, the one we've because part of our office of e-diplomacy is the customer liaison division, and I said, look, customer support is not. It's not something you're born with. So how do we develop that skill set and how do we celebrate it? So we began having kind of brown bag sessions and bringing people in from the outside. We had Craig Newmark, you know, founder of Craigslist, who, you know, it's just founder and customer service. When the founder has customer service in his title, you know that it's pretty important. And so I had Craig talk about his experience. You know, we had the founder of Geek Squad come in and talk as well, and are some folks from Consular Affairs who do really good customer service. So really trying to say, you know, doing what you've always done is not always enough, and it's not done until the customer tells you it's done, not that the clock's run out or you've done what you've always done or done what you're supposed to do. So getting that, and it's from the Geek Squad, what I heard and which was I've really taken to heart is good customer service comes from people who are curious and people who are always wondering why and why or why not. Those people make great customer service, people. So
what does the future hold for e-diplomacy at the U.S. Department of State? We will ask Richard Boley, director of the Office of e-Diplomacy within the U.S. Department of State, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.